friend, Jim Maurer. Jim was born and raised in Boone. He married his high school sweetheart, Chelsea, and together they're raising two boys. Jim has defined his career as a commitment to public service. Following 9/11, Jim joined the Iowa Army National Guard, where his unit was deployed for 23 months, which is the longest deployment of any group in the Iraq War. When he returned home from service, he went to work at the Pentagon under the Obama administration, where he worked to save taxpayers billions, that's a billion, of dollars with making the Army more efficient. He's running for Congress to continue his commitment to public service and to America, and to build an economy that provides opportunity for everyone who works hard to get ahead and build a future for themselves and their family. Jim also has a very unusual and I think important story to share with us about the adversity that he's faced in his own life. He has, I think, overcome some amazing odds. And I hope that you're ready to help send Jim to Congress and see that the 3rd District is properly represented. Please introduce, or please welcome my friend, Jim Maurer.
Well, good morning. I am so glad to be with you this morning. I appreciate this warm welcome. I want to thank my friend Matt, Senator McCoy, who we are very, very lucky. We are all very lucky to have had Matt in the state Senate for the previous years and hopefully for many years to come. I also want to introduce Michael Weeks, sitting next to Matt. Michael is my LGBT chair of my campaign, and so has been. When did you become the chair of the LGBT committee? March. So he has been working on outreach on that front. He's been a great friend for many years and is doing a great job. So thank you, Michael, for all that you do as well. I'm going to speak for a few minutes. I want to leave plenty of time to answer your questions. I think that would probably be the most valuable thing. Again, I'm Jim Maurer, running for Congress here in the 3rd District, which is the 16 counties here in southwestern Iowa. And I'm running for Congress. My entire career has been in service to Iowa and service to my country in one capacity or another. As Matt said, I grew up on a family farm in rural Boone County. But when I was 7 years old, my father was killed in a farming accident. And we lost the farm and moved into town where my mother worked for a modest income to take care of my sister and I. But the only thing that really kept my family from falling so far down that we couldn't get back up was the basic social safety net. And in particular, Social Security survivor benefits. And that's what formed my worldview and my understanding of how important public policy is from a very young age. And it's why I'm a Democrat, because my core belief is that when one of us falls down, we are all better off when we help one another get back up and keep moving forward. So after high school, I married my high school sweetheart, Chelsea. We have two wonderful sons together. If you've seen any of the TV ads, they're the two good-looking young boys. They get their looks from their mother. And after the September 11th attacks, I joined the Iowa Army National Guard, was deployed to Iraq. And as trying as that experience was, it's also what gives me such great confidence about the future of our country, because I serve side by side with other young Iowans and other young Americans who were willing to sacrifice everything for the future of this country. And some of them did. But it is why I'm so determined to ensure that our best days are ahead of us, not behind us. So when I got back from Iraq, I went to work on veterans issues and veterans policies. I was Joe Biden's veterans director for a period of time. I actually went back to Iraq as civilian as well, doing intelligence work as a civilian. And then, as Senator McCoy said, I joined the Obama administration. I spent 3.5 years in the Obama administration at the Pentagon. And I had a couple different roles there. I had one of the most ambiguous titles you could probably come up with. It was Special Assistant to the Undersecretary of the Army. And what that really meant was I was essentially the Undersecretary's chief of staff. And the Undersecretary of the Army is also the Chief Management Officer of the Army, so he's in charge of all the Army's business operations. And so Congress mandated that the Army create an Office of Business Transformation. We'd had a decade of war. We'd been investing in a lot of different business operations, thrown a lot of money at issues. And it was well intended. It was meant to get equipment and services to warfighters as quickly as possible. But we'd thrown a lot of money at these issues. And we weren't necessarily spending it in the best way. So I oversaw the establishment of the Army Office of Business Transformation. And what we did was work with the defense industry, we worked with Congress, we worked with the politics inside the Pentagon, which are about as complicated as politics outside the Pentagon. And without cutting any services, saved about $3.5 billion of taxpayer money. And so that's what my experience is. That's why I believe in good public policy. Now, it's a lot easier to save billions of dollars at the Pentagon than it is at the state level. The budgets are a little different there. Billions at the Pentagon are thrown around quite a bit. I also was the Army's lead representative to the Council of Governors, where I worked with the 54 state and territory governors on Army National Guard issues. I was involved with a lot of different projects at the Pentagon, and I was very proud to serve in the Obama administration. Contrary to what a lot of people say out there, I think the president's doing a pretty good job. I think people are starting to see that here as we approach this election, I think I just saw the president's approval numbers were at record highs. So people, I think, really understand that President Obama has been doing a pretty good job. And we made significant progress in the 8 years that he has been president. One thing that happened when I was at the Pentagon was ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now, before we were able to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Congress asked each service to produce a readiness report that said, if we ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we allowed soldiers to serve openly in the military, would it have an impact on the readiness of our military? And that was the argument that Republicans really wanted to use, is that if they could get the generals to say that ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell would impact the military readiness, then we couldn't do it. They didn't want to do it. Well, we had a board of generals that produced a readiness report. And we wanted to produce a unanimous report that said this would not impact the readiness of our services. And we had one general that was holding out. I'm not going to name his name. He's a 3-star general. He'd spent more than 30 years in military service. And he was holding out. And so I'd worked with him on some business transformation issues and scheduled a time to sit down with him. And I said, General, I'm hearing some things that you might be weighing in that ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell would negatively impact the readiness of the Army. And he said, I haven't made up my mind yet. I said, General, I've served in the Army. You've served in the Army a lot longer than I had, over 30 years. And I said, you've served with a lot of soldiers over the years. Some of them, maybe you thought, were hiding who they really were. Many who you maybe didn't have any idea. I said, but the reality is, we have soldiers who are serving their country every day, who are putting their lives on the line, some of whom who've died for our country, who have to lie about who they are every day in order to serve their country. And that's not right. And that's what I want you to think about when you have to make this decision. And I'm very proud that the United States Army produced a readiness report that unanimously recommended ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So this is my background on these issues. And my campaign has been focused on my working families agenda, the issues that impact every single family across Iowa and across our country. Raising the minimum wage, access to quality and affordable education, quality and affordable health care. Because of the great work that Tom Harkin did, you can't lose your job if you get sick or one of your family members gets sick, but you can still go bankrupt. We have to pass paid family and medical leave. So there are three defining moments that I view in my life that have formed my worldview and have created my priorities. Number one was my father being killed in a farming accident. It's why I believe so strongly in the basic social safety net, maintaining Social Security. Number two was the first time when I was in Iraq and you realized you weren't going to bring all your soldiers home. That we have to do better for our veterans. That too many times, even though it shouldn't be a partisan political issue, we're still not getting the job done for our veterans. Number three is in 2013, my youngest son Jack was diagnosed with a rare neurodegenerative disease. And to be in a doctor's office and to have a doctor tell you that there is no treatment, there is no cure, and that his life expectancy is 24 is not something that you ever anticipate as a parent. And I think for many of us, there are a lot of things that you see happen in the world that you never expect them to happen to you. They always happen to somebody else. And I believe that we've got a lot of work to do. We've made a lot of steps forward, but that we can do better. And that's really what the clear choice is in this election. Whether we continue to move our country in the right direction, whether we continue to go forward, or, on the other side, those who believe our only path forward is to stop and to go backwards. And that really is what's at stake. We've made great steps forward over the past 8 years. But right now, we have a Republican nominee for president, and we have a representative here in the 3rd District who supports him and supports that extreme agenda and would take our country backwards. So while I disagree with David Young on a whole lot of issues, the most disappointing thing that I have seen was this past spring. Some of you may have remembered this. But there was an LGBT non-discrimination bill up for a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives. And David did the right thing initially. He voted for it. But then Republicans realized that it was actually going to pass. And they didn't want that. And on C-SPAN, live on TV, Republican leaders went up to him and told him to change his vote. And he did. He voted to allow businesses to discriminate against people because of who they are. So it's that simple. It's that clear. I'm proud to have the support of great organizations like Human Rights Campaign. I'm proud to tell you that I will be a champion and a fighter for equality for everyone. And you will have a representative in me who will continue to move our country forward and not stop. So I'm glad to be with you. I ask for your support and would love to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, sir. What's the registered voter distribution within the 3rd district?
Absolutely. The reason you're seeing a lot of so many TV ads already is we live in one of the closest districts in the country. Essentially, it's evenly split between Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. It's about 170,000 registered Republicans, 160,000 registered Democrats, and about 150,000 registered Independents. And so it's an incredibly close district. The president did carry these 16 counties twice, 54% in 2008 and 52% in 2012. But it's an incredibly close race. It has several times been listed as one of the 10 most competitive seats in the country. Everyone's throwing everything they've got at us because this race could go either way.
What about the urban rural distribution?
About 60% of the voters live in Polk County in the district. Dallas County is about another 10%. Council Bluffs, Pottawatomie County is the other major population center. That's where a lot of the population is heavily. But we also have, very rural counties as well.
Right. Well, but the urban tend to be more Democratic, while the rural tend to be more Republican.
Absolutely. We were just talking about that while we were having breakfast, and you're right. Unfortunately, the rural areas do tend to be more Republican, and which is baffling to me because, I grew up in a rural area on a farm, and when you look at the issues that rural Iowa faces, for those folks to be voting for Republicans, frankly, is counter to their own interests. And that's a
tradition.
Yeah.
Daddy's Republican, Grandpa's Republican.
That's right. Well, we need to change that. Thank you. John.
We've seen with the collapse of the Soviet Union a different dynamic internationally, and a difference in what may be required of the United States, either economically or militarily. I'd like to have you comment from your past experience.
Absolutely. well, when you look at the dynamics at play, you know, Russia is a major world power. You know, when we're talking about other nations that are maybe more regional power, don't have much of a of an impact. Russia's, you know, a major world power, and they have significant economic impact. They obviously their military presence in the region is very important. And obviously what they're doing in Syria is primarily based on those economic and geographic interests that they have in the region. When it comes to dealing with Russia, you know, the United States is still the number one power in the world, economically, militarily, and so we have a lot of resources. And we need to leverage our what we have economically. When you look at when we've put sanctions on Russia in the past and the impact that that's had on their economy, et cetera, you know, we have a lot of tools when it comes to dealing with Russia, both in soft and hard power. And so I think, you know, we need to be, you know, very cautious in how we use those. But, you know, Russia's going to do what, you know, they're going to perform that cost-benefit analysis of what they believe is in their best interest. And, you know, we have to confront this Russian influence that they seem to be pushing in Europe and in the Middle East specifically. But we need to work with our allies, our NATO allies, and, you know, that's a big problem with, you know, Donald Trump, for example, you know, essentially backing away from NATO, say that he wouldn't necessarily back our NATO allies. You know, NATO, it gives us an extreme reach around the globe, you know, and people forget that the NATO charter that allows for defense to invoke the Mutual Defense Pact has only been invoked once, and it was after September 11th. And so our NATO allies really have stood with us. We need to make sure that we do everything we can to stand with our NATO allies as well. You know, but when you talk about Putin and Russia and what they're doing, you know, specifically in Crimea and Syria, the United States has a lot of options. I think that people kind of act like we don't, but I think that's a false choice. But we have to be careful. You know, we don't want to create a proxy war. And frankly, you know, post 9/11, for a while there, we had a pretty good dynamic where Russia, you know, was seeking stability, where they were looking to fight terror and extremist groups as well. And so for a while there, we kind of, you know, had a good thing going, so to speak. And I think we just need to figure out how to get back to that point. But we have to push back against that Russian influence. But I think we can do it using all of our soft and hard power tools without, you know, again, essentially creating a proxy fight in Syria where we have Russian-backed forces and American-backed forces fighting against one another. I think that's something, I mean, that's, I think, our first objective. But we have to use all the tools in our tool chest. And I think that up until this point, we want to keep that isolated to what was happening on the ground in the Syria, but I think we might have to broaden that front and start kind of putting pressure on other points on Russia that will help bring them to the table when it comes to what's happening on the ground in Syria.
Just weeks after the Orlando massacre at the Pulse nightclub, David Young spoke here and was under fire for some time for not passing legislation to help with some regulation of gun violence. Finally, one of our members asked if he was taking funds from the NRA, and he quietly admitted that he had. And that ended the entire conversation. he wanted to go further, and everybody in the room just went, we're done with you.
Yeah.
So my question for you is, are you planning to take money from the NRA?
Well, you know, I'm not planning on it. I don't think they're planning on offering it either. You know, on that front, you know, last week?
Yeah.
Okay. Time gets a little funny here towards the end of the campaign. Last week, Senator McCoy and I did an event up at the state capitol with former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords was in town to talk about the need for sensible gun legislation. Primarily, you know, look, when you talk to most folks, you know, we live in Iowa. It's a rural state. We've got a lot of gun owners. And, you know, me personally, I grew up on a farm. We had guns. I'm a gun owner. I've slept with an assault rifle in a war zone many a nights. Don't tell my wife, I guess. But, you know, there's some very common sense things that we can do. Background checks for every single purchase. I think when you pull that, it's, you know, 95%. If we can't pass something that 95% of Americans support, what are we doing? And, you know, no fly, no buy. That's been something that's come up. If you're on the no-fly list, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. This doesn't sound very complicated. What's been interesting is David Young, when he's here in Iowa, says, he was asked about this by the press, he said, I would vote for legislation like no-fly, no-buy. He has voted 27 times to block that bill from coming to a vote on the floor. So he can say he hasn't voted against the bill, but he's voted 27 times to block consideration of it. So he has a very clear record. And again, you know, taking a lot of money on that front is very telling. And so David Young is not someone who's ever going to vote for common sense gun legislation.
So I hear and read often that people, young people under 20 and so on, are convinced that Social Security won't be around for them. And this social net that you talked about help you and me. What would you do to make sure that to strengthen Social Security?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, first of all, this is a myth that Republicans have pushed for a long time because they want to push efforts to privatize Social Security, invest the money in Wall Street, and do things like that. When you look at the Social Security Trust Fund and where it's at, the very, very worst case scenario under Social Security is that there would be a 30% cut. If we exhausted the trust fund and you looked at how much money was coming into Social Security and how much was being paid out, it would result in a 30% cut of benefits, which would be disastrous. But still, 70% of the program would be there. So it's a myth that the program would just disappear. There'd be a 30% cut, which would be awful. When you look at what we need to do to shore up and strengthen Social Security, Senator Harkin proposed several bills on this front. You know, unfortunately, we didn't get too far on them. The easiest, most straightforward thing we can do on Social Security is to lift the cap on contributions. You know, right now you only pay into Social Security for the first $118,000 of income, which means that if you're a millionaire, you know, making millions of dollars a year, billions of dollars a year, you only pay into Social Security for the first $118,000. And that is the most straightforward thing that we can do to fund the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, I'm willing to say that. I've been attacked for saying that. You know, they'll say, you know, raising taxes and all these other things. But the Republicans, when you ask them about it, they don't offer anything. The only thing they offer is raising the retirement age, cutting benefits, privatizing Social Security. And I think that, you know, when you present those two options to the American people, I think very clearly that they would rather keep Social Security as it is and keep the program strong. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, something that, why for me, it's a pretty clear choice on what we need to do to shore up the program.
Could you talk about the U.S. Supreme Court for a moment?
Absolutely. Well, you know, unfortunately in the House of Representatives, I can't do anything about the Supreme Court vacancy, but we absolutely need to have 9 justices on the court. Again, you look at, you know, the progress that we have been able to make over the past 8 years. In many cases, the court, has not been that helpful in some ways, and in other ways they have been. But we need to have the full nine justices. And, you know, confirming that ninth justice, having a Supreme Court in place that believes in equality, that doesn't believe that money is speech, for example, so we don't have all this unlimited campaign. You know, one of the biggest problems that we have in the United States right now is our campaign finance system. Unlimited secret money that can come from corporations. Republicans even voted to block allowing the IRS to see where the money has come from to ensure that it's not coming from foreign countries. So right now, the rules essentially have allowed a backdoor loophole where a foreign country could make contributions to a super PAC, and nobody's ever going to know it because you don't have to disclose where your money comes from. So that's how broken our campaign finance system is. And the Supreme Court and Citizens United ruled that money is speech, and so it can be unlimited. It can come from anywhere. And so that's how important the court is. And the next court is going to decide a lot of important issues. And we have the potential, again, to go backwards on a lot of issues if we're not able to fill that vacancy with a justice who's gonna rule in my view the right way.
How would you recast the second the constitutional provision on freedom of speech to make it possible to curtail Citizens United? Because I think the Supreme Court's logic was sound that pricing and advertising. Spending money like that is an expression, speech. We have one of the problems is the concept that a corporation is a legal person. And but that could be a piece of it. How would you actually curtail Citizens United without affecting individuals, what most people would consider real freedom, free speech?
Well, I think it's just that very narrow interpretation, and I would respectfully disagree on what I think you stated there. I mean, I think that previously our campaign finance laws had defined an individual as a person, and I think that broadening that definition to corporations, to businesses, allowing unlimited contributions, and so I think it could be a very narrow ruling that would counter Citizens United, but obviously the ideal situation would be a constitutional amendment where we stated that money is not speech, and we could limit that campaign, the amount that outside campaign finance would be allowed. Jonathan?
Even if you say that money is speech, I've been published in the Des Moines Register a time or two, and it used to be that people could send in comments and whatnot online anonymously. And usually those comments, when they were anonymous, just got more and more and more vicious. And often as not, didn't have anything to do with me or the article I'd written, had everything to do with each other, and they were attacking each other. And finally, the Register changed their policy and said, it can't be anonymous. You write a comment, but you got to identify yourself. So even if you say money is speech, it seems to me, you can say it doesn't get to be anonymous.
Right.
If you want to give money, fine, but let's find out who you are and who you're giving money to.
Well, and I think disclosure is definitely the first step of just saying, where's the money coming from? And so at least you can point to that. But again, the fact that we can, individual contributions to my campaign are capped at $2,700. You can give $2,700 to my campaign as an individual. And you're all welcome to, by the way. But again, you can go out and write $1 million from a corporate account, from a business account, from any account, and start running attack ads tomorrow with it. And we don't know where it came from. And it is unlimited. And so, you look at our previous attempts at campaign finance reform, McCain-Feingold, et cetera, we're pretty successful at trying to at least narrow that down as to, and I don't talk to any voter who's very happy with our campaign finance system. And that's what's so bizarre, I think, is, David Young opposes any attempts to change our campaign finance system. And when I talk to voters, I don't hear anybody who's happy with especially around the caucuses. Here in Iowa, we have a unique perspective. I mean, every single TV ad is a political ad, and not very many of them actually come from candidates. They come from super PACs. And we don't know where it's coming from. And it's just ridiculous the amount of money that's spent on that front as well.
Yes. Not a question as much as a request.
Sure.
That's if you do get elected, anything that you can do to increase mental health coverage and mental health services in the state would be a huge help. I've got two quick stories on that. One is I had a sister-in-law who we didn't realize at the time that bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, alcoholic, going through domestic abuse, the whole nine yards. At one point, we finally convinced her that it was in her best interest to check into a place like Mount Pleasant. But by the time we finally got her to see that would be a benefit, there were no beds left. Mm-hmm. There was nowhere in the entire state that she could go.
Yeah.
She would be dead if I hadn't been paying for motel rooms, driving her to therapy sessions. But I was living in Minneapolis at the time, and down here just like she'd be dead if she didn't. Yeah. And I need to bridge that gap.
Mm-hmm.
Now you fast forward about 4 years, and I've got one of my foster kids. I can't put anything else up to the psychotic episode.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was going to go upstairs and grab a knife and cut the throat of my oldest boy. So we called social services, finally get them to come out. It's Thanksgiving weekend, so no one wants to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're trying to figure out where he can go.
Yeah.
Like, well, this place is full, that place is full.
Mm-hmm.
And finally they told, this place can take him for the weekend, but you've got to take him down there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can get him up to Ames, because there's nowhere in Des Moines that's open. And you can get him up there, and then once you're there, kids in Ames need to go there. They don't want to Fort Dodge, because that place is full.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go.
Yeah. Now, we have a mental health crisis on our hands, both at the state level, which is something that I know Senator McCoy is working on, but at the federal level, the resources aren't there. And, you know, when it comes to investing in mental health services, it really is that it's an investment. Because the cost of not investing in it just simply moves that investment other places. It moves it to the criminal justice system. It moves it to all the other costs to society of not investing in mental health. And so I'm a strong proponent of that. And again, I think that's the stark divide is there are some very clear areas in our country that we need to invest in. That when we have invested in the past, we've seen huge payoffs. And there's plenty of evidence to show that. You know, investing in education. When we invest in education, we see a huge long-term benefit. When we invest in infrastructure, roads and bridges, when we invest in scientific research, huge payoffs. You know, you look at the second half of the 20th century, post-World War II, the investment that we put in infrastructure, the investment that we put in science, NASA, other scientific research, that's really how we created an America that is the greatest nation on earth, that is the wealthiest nation on earth. Those investments are what paid off. And we have stopped investing in those areas in a lot of ways. And because they don't want to do the investment up front. They would rather pay for it later. But it's pretty straightforward. It's just like if you have, you know, if you got a leak in your roof, if you don't fix it now, it's going to cost you a heck of a lot more later. And that's really the divide that exists, is that argument. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. We have a tradition of giving a token of appreciation to our speakers. This is a recording of the Des Moines Gaiman's course that I'm sure you'll enjoy.
Thanks so much. Yeah. I really appreciate
it. Thanks again.
Thanks again.
We're all involved in politics, whether we vote or not. And if you don't vote, you've been involved. And if you do vote, you're involved. It is imperative that every one of us make our involvement one of actively participating by voting. The earlier, as possible, as often as possible. And certainly, as quickly as possible, so you can't possibly change your mind. That's the beauty of voting early. A couple of other items I want to bring to your attention. Next Wednesday is the 12th, not the 11th. Sorry about that. I have a sad bit of news. Bruce Wilson's husband, Michael Sinks, passed away since our last meeting. I want to express to Bruce our condolences on that loss. It was unexpected, and it's a sad day to lose one of our members. And we'll be thinking of you, Bruce. Our next meeting is going to be on November the 4th. Our speaker will be Dr. Maria Filippone. She is just back from the Middle East, and her presentation is going to be talking about the situation in Gaza and what needs to be done in order to save Gaza. And then in the same sort of vein, in December, on the 2nd of December, our speaker is going to be Mel Duncan. Mel Duncan is one of the founders of the International Nonviolence Peace Force. And this is an organization that goes around the world where there is conflict and violence going on, and goes on the front line to help save lives of innocent civilians and non-combatants. So both of those should be very interesting. Look forward to seeing all of you at the November and the December meetings. Thanks for being here today.